Knowing the stories behind Michelangelo's artistic struggles can provide an enticing context to the actual works he created.
The story of the tomb of Julius II is probably one of art history's greatest mysteries.
Coming up, we'll hear what complicated Michelangelo's dedication to his art throughout his life. Irish guides tip us off on what to see in Dublin and what's new in the Irish capital, like the Museum of Modern Literature at St. Stephen's Green.
The building was the first building ever to be built on St. Stephen's Green, so it is also a metaphor for colonization.
And they're working to preserve the collection in the long room at the Trinity College Library.
They're actually decanting the books, and each book is going to be individually restored.
Plus, listeners tell us about the lengths they go to see the art they love in person. It's all just ahead on today's Travel with Rick Steves. Come along. They're getting ready to close the long room at Trinity College's old library in Dublin. It's to start a long overdue restoration of the dusty and historic collection where the 1,200-year-old Book of Kells is displayed. In just a bit, guides from Ireland update us on what's new in Dublin and recommend not-to-be-missed sights and experiences to fully enjoy the Irish capital. And we'll open the phones to hear from listeners about the lengths they go to view the art they admire in person. Planning a trip to see a work of art where it's meant to be seen can make a huge difference. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves, getting to know the story behind Michelangelo and how he struggled for years to build an elaborate tomb that was supposed to be his greatest work of all. When traveling in Italy, you can hardly avoid Michelangelo, his compelling life story, his prolific work as both a sculptor, a painter, and an architect, and his role as sort of the face of the Renaissance. It's inescapable to any art lover traveling in Italy. Virtually every tourist has Michelangelo's David, his Pieta, and the Sistine Chapel on their bucket list. But what few travelers know is the project that dominated so much of Michelangelo's career was a massive tomb for the greatest pope of his lifetime, Pope Julius II. And while Michelangelo struggled to complete the tomb, the very vision of the audacious tomb sparked the creation of lots of great art that continues to fascinate travelers today. Gene Openshaw is a friend and fellow tour guide who I've collaborated with since the day we graduated from high school. He's co-authored many of my books and TV scripts. Anytime I have a writing project with a focus on art or history, Gene's the guy I want at my side. Gene has just finished a multi-year project writing a book about the long and winding story of that audacious tomb. The book's called Michelangelo at Midlife, Chasing the Tomb of Julius II. And Gene joins us now for a little quality time with perhaps the greatest artist of all time. Gene, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Rick.
Man, your book takes us on a fascinating trip. It's like a journey of discovery across Europe, tracing clues and the mysterious project. Give us a little context about this.
The story of the tomb of Julius II is probably one of art history's greatest mysteries. And the book traces, as you say, those clues all across Europe. And it stops in places that travelers today would fully recognize. You know, it starts in Florence, Michelangelo's hometown. People today walk the same alleyways and same streets and see the same Brunelleschi's dome that Michelangelo saw. Then it goes to Carrara, where Michelangelo quarried marble for the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
It makes stops in Venice, where Michelangelo escaped from his troubles. And then he goes into Tuscany, where he, well, frankly, where he enjoyed a lot of great white Trebbiano wine, just as travelers do today. And the story ends in Rome, which is the eternal city where Michelangelo intended to build the tomb of Julius II.
Okay, now this long and winding road, it took a big part of his life. I mean, what, from about 1505 to 1545? That's 500 years ago.
He started it when he was an optimistic young man of 30,
mm-hmm.
and he finished it as an old man of 70.
What a story. I mean, we're all so enamored with Michelangelo, but this is like a psychological study of him almost. What is the vision of this tomb, first of all? Just what did he intend to build?
Well, the tomb was supposed to be huge. He was intending it as his magnum opus, bigger than David, bigger than the Pietà. What the tomb originally envisioned was a 50-foot-tall tomb to bury this pope, Julius II. It was going to be 3 stories tall, made completely of marble, and bristling with some 40 statues, many of the statues as big as David.
So that would have taken, realistically, lifetimes to do.
Exactly. It was an undertaking that really hadn't been done for 1,000 years, since the ancient Romans built their mega projects. It was kind of like building a medieval cathedral. But Michelangelo intended to do it in his lifetime, all by himself.
Now, audacious as that must have been, and I think unrealistic as that must have been, even if everything went smoothly, a word I learned in your book, Michelangelo at Midlife, is non finito.
Unfinished.
Unfinished,
yes.
Yeah.
And it was something that Michelangelo struggled with the tomb. But it was also something he struggled with in his other works in life. And that's very much what the book is about. Michelangelo had this great audacious dream, but then life got in the way.
Yeah.
And he ran into detours and delays, budget shortages, fickle popes, other projects that he was getting asked to do, all while what he was really trying to do is complete this magnum opus of the tomb that would cement his legacy.
Wow. And today it's kind of like the splattered remains of his tumultuous life scattered around the museums of Europe. I mean, when you think about what was sculpted because of the tomb but never ended up in the tomb, you can find it. It's almost like a grand tour of Europe.
You're absolutely right. He carved statues that were never even put on the tomb. Those are the ones that, as you mentioned, are scattered all across Europe.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Gene Openshaw, and his book is Michelangelo at Midlife, Chasing the Tomb of Julius II. And Gene joins us now to get into Michelangelo's psyche, to get into his mind, to get into his frustrations as he tried to put together this audacious project. So, Gene, some of these works of Michelangelo that we all know and love.
We do. For example, here's one that many people will know. Many people have gone to see David, right? Uh-huh. Well, David wasn't intended for the tomb. But when you see David, many people notice, oh, well, what are these 4 statues that line the nave leading up to David? Those were intended for the tomb. Those were the prisoners. They were going to be some of his greatest works. But as visitors to David can see, they were left non finito.
And when you look at David, you see finito. I mean, that's polished and beautiful. And then you look on your left and your right, and you see these are more than statues. These are power sources.
That contrast really tells a lot about the story of the tomb of Julius II. Michelangelo began the tomb just as he had finished David. He was a young man in the prime of his life. He was Earth's greatest sculptor. He was like a young David. And then, when he began the project, the prisoners represent the next 40 years. The struggle that he had to finish the prisoners and to finish the rest of the tomb.
And those would have been in his ultimate vision?
Well, ultimate vision is right where we're getting to it. He kept changing his vision all the time. At one point, those 2 slaves would have flanked either side of the ceremonial doorway that led inside the tomb where Pope Julius II would have been interred.
So this tomb that he envisioned was like a giant marble pyramid, just ringed with symbolic statues. Was it going to be a pyramid that was actually in St. Peter's Basilica?
Exactly. That was his initial vision, was going to be this 50-foot-tall, 3-story statue that would stand in the center of St. Peter's, right in the heart of Christianity.
And it ended up in a small church that very few tourists go to.
Don't give the story
come
away.
On, come on. but yes. we ultimately see Moses. We go to the St. Peter's in Chains Church, about a 10-minute walk uphill from the Colosseum, to see Michelangelo's masterpiece, Moses. But I've gone to that for decades, but I've never fully appreciated the fact that that really is kind of physically what ended up after
all. That's what ended up. For travelers that might have seen the great statue of Moses, you know, he's the one with the horns and he's very powerful and he oozes gravitas. He's muscular and he's got a kind of angry face, bearded face. And Michelangelo eventually chose that statue to anchor the tomb that ended up in the church you're talking about.
Okay.
If you look at Moses and you see how big and powerful he is, multiply that by 40, because there were going to be 40 statues on the tomb, and you get a sense of Michelangelo's original vision.
Now, Gene, the lead character in the book, Sam, who is, I gotta say, wonderfully autobiographical, he was struggling to piece these clues together 500 years later, and he ended up with quite an epiphany when he finally realized where the tomb was. Can you share that?
Yes. Well, first I'll just kind of say, you know, the book is a story of Michelangelo and the tomb that's wrapped in a fictional story, this
right.
character of Sam.
Right.
So we follow Sam through the book as he traces the clues and tries to discover the meaning of the tomb. And then, like you say, where it finally gets near the end is he has a certain epiphany. And where does he have it? In St. Peter's, the very place that Michelangelo hoped to build the tomb but never got a chance to. What he realized, though, is that the tomb story, this long and winding story, eventually led Michelangelo to build St. Peter's Dome.
So you got the dome. That was like the grandest of Michelangelo's projects in many ways.
Exactly. He hoped the tomb would be his magnum opus. It didn't prove to be that way, but ultimately he did build his magnum opus, one of the greatest architectural wonders in the world.
And that Pope is buried right there under the dome.
And the Pope is buried right there.
That's how it functions. Congrats. Bravo, Michelangelo.
So you could almost say he built the tomb of Julius II. And what is the tomb of Julius II? St. Peter's itself.
And today, 500 years later, when we travelers go to Italy to find inspiration, we can find a lot of things that inspire us that, if you dig deeply, we're all part of this dream of a grand tomb.
And Michelangelo left us a lot of the remnants of the tomb that are part of the legacy of the tomb, and they are quite grand. He populated Europe with some of its greatest art. You go to the Louvre and you see the slaves. You go to see David, you see those prisoners. You go to the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence, you see his wonderful statue of Victory. But even more so, the tomb helped him to hone his own craft. So the style that Michelangelo came up with was largely carved with him carving the tomb. It influenced the Baroque world. And like we say, he built St. Peter's. And you know what is probably the biggest legacy of the tomb? It's just the ambition, the sheer audacity. Michelangelo gave the world the idea that a single artist could have such an audacious dream. And that dream has inspired generations to come, from Shakespeare to Beethoven to Van Gogh, and even down to a humble writer that was inspired to write a book about Michelangelo and the tomb.
And that man is sitting right across from me now, Gene Openshaw. Gene, thank you for the audacity to try to put this all together and share it in a fascinating read. Again, the book is Michelangelo at Midlife. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you, Rick.
You'll find more at ricksteves.com/radio. What art have you made it a point to visit in person? We'll check in with listeners making their own art itineraries in just a bit, right after we enjoy The Art of Good Living in Dublin and hear what's new in the Irish capital. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. Ireland's capital and largest city is a delight to visit, no matter if your family came from Ireland or not. Dublin steals the show with its exceptional arts, entertainment, food, and fun, with an emphasis on literature. We're getting an update from our guides Joe Burke and Lynn Corkin right now on what you should add to your itinerary, whether it's your first time in Dublin or whether you've been coming back and back and back. Joe and Lynn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just get a sense that you enjoy showing people around Dublin. Tell me just a little bit of background, Joe, on your guiding and why Dublin fits for your guiding sort of passions.
Well, I guess I worked in Italy as a guide, so I developed a big interest in history. Then I also do a lot of architectural photography. Dublin is quite a beautiful Georgian city. I photograph a lot of Georgian buildings and kind of Palladian architecture. And also that architecture is a leftover from colonization.
I was going to say, that was from when Dublin was the second city of Great Britain.
Absolutely,
it?
Yeah.
And all this English style, neoclassical or Palladian.
Yeah, and that's amazing because in the 70s, people in Dublin didn't really respect that because it was a metaphor for colonization
and
subjugation. And it wasn't until a group of architectural students that were studying architecture in Dublin that kind of barricaded themselves into these buildings and said, no, you shouldn't knock these.
Right.
And that was the start of the Royal Georgian Society.
Hey, Lynn, how about you? Tell us about where you're from and your guiding and
yes,
your take on Dublin.
I'm from Northern Ireland, so I hadn't been a lot to Dublin in my younger years, maybe for the occasional concert. But now I go a lot as part of my work. And it's a completely different atmosphere from Belfast. It's twice the size for a start. It's much more cosmopolitan. It's much more centre of administration and government rather than that great industrial heritage that Belfast would have. So it has a completely different character. It has beautiful architecture, the Georgian architecture that Joe has just mentioned. That is just not so prevalent in Belfast because of its different history. So it really feels somewhere different to me, different from what I would have grown up with, and has restaurants and a variety of people, food, culture, and just that cosmopolitan feel.
Now, when you talk about, I mean, this is a discussion about Dublin, but I think with the new trains, the fast trains and so on, Dublin and Belfast, people should remember, complement each other, and they're very easy to connect by train.
Mm.
They are, and we're about to get a super new railway station in Belfast that's going to have an hourly service to Dublin, all singing, all dancing. New railway station called Grand Central, and it is a reflection of the demand that there is now from Belfast to Dublin both ways.
That's a constructive, healthy thing.
It absolutely is. It's a benefit of the peace process. There's no question about it.
Peace for stability and prosperity. Let's get to know each other.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, when we're in Dublin, what would you say is the proper smart approach for a tourist who might be overwhelmed with all the things to do, Joe?
Well, just in 2019, a new Museum of Literature opened in Dublin, and it's got really favourable reviews. And in many ways, the building was the first building ever to be built on St. Stephen's Green. So it is also a metaphor for colonisation. But it's an ideal opportunity if you want to go in and see how these amazing houses were with the Italian stucco work. It's a unique opportunity to see the inside of these houses. Then this museum is dedicated to James Joyce, and Ireland has always had a very difficult relationship with Joyce because, of course, he was quite explicit in his kind of outspoken way of the Catholic Church. And he, you know, being one of the great literary writers of the 20th century, Ireland has always had a kind of a fractured relationship
with Joyce.
Because
a lot of that is from the time when Dublin was really quite British.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In fact, when we have that phrase, beyond the pale, that means where all the barbarians are. And
yeah,
that was literally, there was a region of Ireland which was civilized in English,
yes,
and proper.
Yes.
And then beyond, I don't know what the pale is, but that must have been some kind of border. And beyond that were the angry indigenous people.
Absolutely. It was like Hadrian's Wall. The pale was a flat area of land outside Dublin, and anything beyond that pale was totally barbaric. It was the native indigenous people.
Yeah.
And, of course, when you colonize people as well, you have to demonize them. So, you know, there's a whole process with all of that colonization. So you have to be the bringer of civility.
Civility, yes.
You know,
bring them a good Protestant approach to God.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Well, we've got this positive sort of spirit now where we are grappling with the past and we are celebrating the literature heritage.
Absolutely.
The museum you're talking about, is that the one named Molly or something?
Molly, yeah. Museum Molly. Of Modern Literature. And it's dedicated to Molly Bloom. And since then, it's become, they've kind of extended the whole idea of this museum that it will be for all great new and upcoming writers as well.
So that's great. So a general celebration of Irish literature.
Absolutely, yeah. Right,
because
up to
there's the Writers' House also, well, that was quite nice in the past.
Yes, but that has since, hasn't reopened since COVID.
Okay, so this is the new version of that. Great. And Joe, you said that it was on St. Stephen's Green. This is the beautiful green. It's a big green square,
sure,
surrounded
yeah
by beautiful architecture at the top of Grafton Street.
Grafton Street, that's
and
it.
And to me, Grafton Street is the strolling boulevard of Dublin.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you go downhill from there to Trinity College.
Yes.
And then across O'Connell Bridge. And then up O'Connell Street.
Up O'Connell Street.
And in a lot of ways, that's the spine of Dublin, I think you could say.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's where all the historical kind of buildings are. It's also where all our national kind of heroes are, like Daniel O'Connell on O'Connell Street.
Yeah.
And the other thing with this museum is they have a fantastic private garden out the back. and they have a beautiful bookshop downstairs.
Yep.
And then they have this lovely eatery where they serve like sourdough bread and really high quality
I
food.
I love that. I love so what Dublin does to give it get the experience a little more experiential.
Yeah, in the sense it can cover a lot, because the building was the first part of University College Dublin.
Uh-huh.
So at that time there was just Trinity College, and that was ostensibly for English,
you know,
Protestant.
You could complement that visit, an elegant townhouse, with a visit to the Henrietta Museum.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Can you explain to us the Henrietta Museum?
Well, the Henrietta Museum is a wonderful example of, I guess, the transition from the gentrified Dublin, when Dublin was the second city of the British Empire, and then these houses that were very grand and beautifully built turned into the worst slums of Europe after the famine.
And that's where you get this very gritty reality,
look at
the hardship of the Irish people in tough times. You can see that in this museum. It's remarkable how well preserved it is.
It's incredible. The one thing, though, if you are booking this museum, you do have to book about a week in advance, because they only take very small groups. And the tour is really intimate. And when you go into the old parts of the buildings, you can see the apartments just as they were. So it's a really authentic experience.
You guys know how to travel, and that's what we want to inspire our listeners to do. I was, just before we went on our recording here, we were talking, you didn't fly from Ireland straight to Seattle. You stopped in New York for a week.
Absolutely.
And you told me all of the things you did in a week in New York, and you must have planned things in advance.
Oh, yes, yeah. And one of the things I planned and went to was the Tenement Museum in New York City.
There you go.
And there was various themed tours, and I chose to do the one which was called After the Famine.
Uh-huh.
And it featured the story of, an Irish emigrant to New York and her life and all that. And, you could see the similarities, the working class situation, whether it was New York or Dublin, is very similar. You know, these houses that had once been grand
Absolutely.
Buildings for the upper classes were now like maybe 100 people on one corridor.
Well, a lot of times you look at a grand mansion once for an elegant aristocratic family, and you look at the doorbells today and there's 8 doorbells, probably more.
And
that's just a reminder that it used to be for one family, now it's for 8. Our guides to Dublin are fresh in from Ireland and joining us on Travel with Rick Steves to let us know what's new to look for among the traditional pleasures of the Irish capital. Lynn Corkin is a frequent visitor on the train line in from Belfast. And Joe Burke lives just a few miles from the center of town in the suburbs of Dublin. So we're talking about Dublin, and there's a lot of tourism going to Dublin. It's sort of trendy these days.
Mm-hmm.
What should we know about booking in advance? Lynn, what would you say? Are there sites in Dublin that you should, if you're really hell-bent on seeing them, you should book them before you get there?
Yes, I think so. I mean, from the big, big names like the Book of Kells, it has to be booked in advance to these smaller places that we're talking about. I mean, Joe was just
like
talking
Henrietta
Street, the Little Museum of Dublin, which is also on St. Stephen's Green. These are very small buildings that tell a really big story. I know it's a cliche, but they do.
And they learned during COVID how to control crowds. And I think now they're continuing this because they realized, hey, we can control the crowds.
And they realize that people get a better experience with a smaller number. So, I would always say book in advance. I mean,
it really makes two kinds of travelers, those who fumble around without planning in advance, and they have a good time.
Mm.
And those who are the good students that recognize if you really want to do this and this and this, you do a little bit of planning. You send a few emails. You pay for things in advance. You build a schedule. You don't need a fancy tour guide. You just need to be your own tour guide and get your hands on this information. By the way, Lynn, you mentioned the Book of Kells. I understand that the Trinity College Old Library is being restored now.
Yes.
So there's an exhibit that, people go to Dublin just to see the Book of Kells.
Yeah, you can, yes.
Tell us what the Book of Kells is and how we see it now.
The Book of Kells is an illustrated manuscript by monks in the 7th century. It was done on the island of Iona, but the book itself, the precious book, was taken to protect it from marauding Vikings. And it's now a big, big, this exhibition is being restored. You can still see the Book of Kells. But the library, which is also a major attraction at Trinity College, they're actually decanting the books, and each book is going to be individually restored. So they have put on what I think is a very good interactive exhibition all about the Book of Kells, all about great literary figures, because the library really is not the same experience because a lot of the books have gone. You still get to go right. through it, but they're trying to compensate for...
Okay, so there is an experience while the library is closed.
While the library is closed.
And it's called the Book of Kells Experience.
It is, and I think, do you agree, Joe? I think it's very popular with, you know, the add-on experience seems to be popular in films about the Book of Kells.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose when you still go up to the library, you still get that haptic quality,
yeah.
but the smell of the books is gone. But also, I guess they learned from Notre Dame, you know, they had to make this fire safe as well,
oh, yeah.
this building, so, and deworming all the yeah. all the books
oh.
and all that process. So it's going to take a 3-year process, but not unlike what they did in, I know this is abstract, but in Florence, you know, when they had the flood
yeah.
And they realized just the importance of how that became a center for knowledge about painting repair.
Well, it's a responsibility if you have this patrimony.
Absolutely.
You take care of it.
Yeah.
And
that
was a big sort of a thoughtful takeaway from the Notre Dame
yeah.
fire.
Yes.
Is we've got to get our act together. We're going to have more fires in the
sure.
grand churches of Europe. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they take a little bit of a restoration on a place like Trinity College and you see, oh, it's got worms or
mm-hmm.
whatever. And we've got to
yeah.
do more and more and more. And suddenly it's closed for 3 or 4 years. But
yeah.
thank goodness they're taking the big tourist draw and putting it in a special exhibit in the interim.
Absolutely. And the books will be digitized for prosperity, but it's
yeah.
still such a beautiful experience to walk up in that room. The aesthetic quality of that room is sublime.
Irish guides Joe Burke, who lives in the Dublin suburbs, and Lynn Corkin, who comes from Belfast in the north, are updating us on things to do and enjoy in Dublin right now on Travel with Rick Steves. So we just got a couple of minutes left, and there are some cool museums and experiences that really help the traveler put the flesh and bones on epic kind of slices of Irish history. You know, we've got the famine ship, we've got the emigration museum, we've got the general post office with the Civil War and so on. Can you talk a little bit about these attractions that really make learning Irish history vivid and thought-provoking?
I think epic is a wonderful example of that, meaning every person is connected.
And this is the Irish Immigration Museum.
Yes. Yeah.
Considering that Ireland has one of the greatest diasporas of any society.
Absolutely. And it was the CEO of Coca-Cola, Worldwide Coca-Cola. He wanted to tell the story of Irish migration because it had never been told before. So out of his pension fund, he bought that beautiful Victorian building.
Yeah.
And using like high digital experiences that were from, I think Emerson did the contract for it. And now it's become a major tourist attraction. And like the Walk to Santiago, you can get a stamp, like a passport stamp that you've gone through all of these places. And
that's a powerful experience, a beautiful state-of-the-art kind of exhibit.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Then you've got the something that's not high-tech, but it's quite a powerful experience, especially for families, the replica of the famine ship.
Yeah. That's do you want to talk about that, Lynn?
Yes, I took my nieces on it, who were about 10 at the time, and it brought it home to them. This
because
is how people travelled.
And there's people role-playing. You go down into the hold,
yes.
and you've got these ladies that have sick children, and they can't get
yeah.
their food, and they're...
Yes, you know but for kids who are used to flying to America, you know, this is how they went in
yeah.
this... you know, little ship that's about the size of this table and just, and I think it's perfectly located right opposite Epic
yeah.
because this is how people travelled and Ireland's greatest export was its people.
Its people. And coming right up that, you've got that powerful modern art statues of these famine victims.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like ghosts walking along
absolutely.
The harbourfront.
Absolutely. And it's
so
like
moving.
Giacometti, that famous Swiss.
Giacometti, yeah.
And they're Giacometti-esque, but then it, just even that duality, the dog, like in Renaissance art, was a sign of fidelity, but here the dog is a sign of death and how close
yeah.
death is to these people.
Wow.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. So I think for any town, the more you bring to the experience, the more context you have, the more you know what your options are, the more you've
yes.
done your homework and you've made your reservations, the better experience you're going to have. When you go to Dublin, for me, one of the highlights is a little bit of music. I'd love to close our discussion just with your best suggestion about how a visitor can really enjoy the music in the capital city of Dublin.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's one of the unique social spaces we have in Ireland is the pub. The Italians have the piazza, we have the pub. So that's where all our subconscious socialization is done. And in lots of pubs around Dublin, they have traditional Irish music, and it's really impromptu. It's very informal, and it's a very kind of open platform to meet people and just integrate.
And there's the famous ones, the Brazen Head.
The Brazen Head, O'Donoghue's.
And they're good. You go there and they're just good
absolutely.
Music, solid musicians. It's free. You just buy a beer and you have yourself a great evening.
Absolutely. And usually you can spark up a conversation with somebody listening to the music.
Yeah.
So it's
what a pub's all about.
Absolutely, yeah.
So and Lynn, I remember Riverdance was all the rage, and a lot of people still go to Dublin and they want a little bit of Riverdance. So anything like that going on in Dublin?
I go every year to see Riverdance.
Yeah?
I love it, and there's nowhere else to see it but Ireland. It's just such... It's nearly a patriotic act to go to see Riverdance, you know, and it's quite international, I think, as well. I know it sounds corny, but the dancing is superb. They also have, you know, a sort of like tap dance feature. You know, the Irish guys arrive in New York and here's the Puerto Ricans and it's a bit West Side Story-ish. But the audience love it and I love it and I encourage my tour members to go. Because they say, oh, I saw it in Michigan. No, you haven't seen it in Dublin.
There's a lot to be said for that. In
there
situ.
Really is.
You want to see
in
Riverdance
situ.
In Dublin.
That's it,
This has been such a delight talking to both of you, Joe Burke and Lynn Corkin. Best wishes with your guiding.
Great,
and happy travels.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
We've got more to help you plan a trip to Dublin, including our suggestions for a walking tour of the city. It's at ricksteves.com. Have you ever planned a special trip to view the art you love in person? Tell us about it. We'll check in with listeners on Art Adventures next at 877-333-7425. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Are you one of the fortunate ones who's actually seen a Michelangelo sculpture in person? Or had a moment to examine the heavy brushstrokes in a Van Gogh painting up close? You know, it can be a real treat to see great works of art, especially when you've learned a little bit about it in advance. And it's even better when you see them where the artist worked on it or where they intended to be displayed. Let's check in with our listeners now to hear your stories of traveling to see the art you love. We're at 877-333-RICK. Donna from Portland's on the line. Thanks for calling, Donna. What art have you enjoyed lately in Europe?
Well, I went to Venice and went for the Venice Glass Week last September, and it was totally fabulous.
Huh. Venice Glass Week. I haven't heard of that.
Yes, I think I saw it in a guidebook and kept looking it up because I knew I was going to go there. And then as soon as their website was up, I just went crazy looking at the hundreds of exhibits and tours and things and made myself my own little book of all the things I wanted to go and see and sign up for. And it was quite amazing.
Wow. And you actually knew about a certain Italian glass master who was portrayed there?
Well, I had not heard of Lino Taglia Pietro until I went there and saw that exhibit. And his was, I think, my favorite of all the glass that I had seen. And I'm here in Portland, Oregon, and it turns out that he had actually come to Bullseye Glass in Portland and also with the Pilchuck Glass Studio up near Seattle and had influenced a whole generation of glass artists in America.
Huh. Well, I know that Dale Chihuly, who's our favorite hometown boy when it comes to glass art, he was very inspired by Venice, and he famously went to Venice and set up his workshop there and was well-received in Venice. So there must be that connection in Venice with glasswork and the rest of the world when it comes to artisans that are expert on glass.
Yes, and then there were exhibits of artists from all over the world. One of the tours I went on was about bead art, and so I think I was the only non-bead artist in the group, but there were people there from all over the world who made beads, and we went to the studio of a couple who are some really famous bead makers, and the people on my tour were people whose beads were in the Glass Museum as finalists in the competition last year.
You know, that must have been fun to be with a group of people who were really into glass or beads or whatever, and to be able to sort of celebrate that slice of art with them.
Yes, and actually I got quite a bonus because two of the four tours I signed up for, I was the only person who showed up. And so on both those tours, I had my own tour guide, the same guy, Lorenzo. And one of them, I went to this artist studio on Murano, and I actually got my own private lampwork glass bead-making lessons from her because I was the only one. And so when people talk about, you know, Venice is so crowded, I was like, I didn't really have crowds anywhere because these exhibits were in all of these unusual places. They were in hotels, they were in old factories, they were in artist studios and on offshore islands. And I just went around looking at them and there were no crowds and just other fans like me.
Huh. Yeah, because I couldn't help but think that you're talking about remarkably uncrowded experience in the most crowded city for tourism anywhere in Europe, Venice. But you hit it during Glass Week and the festival apparently it attracts specialists, but it's not a massive event. And you found Venice very relaxed and uncrowded during this festival.
Right. And I got to see places that I wouldn't have otherwise gone to. And when I would be out spending the whole day going on my little own list of places I was going to go, I would stop and have lunch in little restaurants in these offbeat places that I would never have found otherwise.
And you spent 2 weeks in Venice on this trip.
I did, and I went alone, and I wasn't sure how that would be, but it was totally fine and great. I found a cute little hotel that I had searched online a lot, and I was really happy there.
Good for you. What was one of your highlights in Venice apart from the Glass Festival?
Well, I have to say, being on the terrace of Peggy Guggenheim's Palazzo, where you could just sit there for an hour on the Grand Canal and imagine that you were back then in your little gown with your fancy drink and surrounded by all the literati and having a fabulous time of old.
Nice.
Yep, I sat there for like an hour just imagining myself there.
Good for you. That's a little art festival of your own right there on Peggy Guggenheim's gallery.
Yes, indeed.
Hey, Donna, thanks for calling and thanks for inspiring us with a different angle on Venice.
Okay, glad to share my experience.
This is fun. We're talking to our travelers about art, and we'd love to talk to you. You can email us anytime at radio@ricksteves.com. Laura's on the line from Cudahy, Wisconsin. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Rick. It's so exciting to be talking to you and to be talking about art.
Oh, yeah.
I first went to Europe in 1978. I went with my university to study in Germany for the summer, and one of the things that was really open to me that year was the art that was in Europe. And every trip I've taken since then has had wonderful art involved in it. But in 1991, I went with a bunch of teachers from Milwaukee.
Uh-huh.
And we went to study art. We had an art teacher who totally changed the way that I taught art to my students.
Mm-hmm.
And There were so many things in that trip that really stuck out to me. Probably, to me, the coolest thing was going to Auvers in France. We had hired a minivan, and we went to see where Vincent van Gogh was buried.
Mm.
And just, you know, we walked from the church that he had painted and walked down the street, and there was a field of sunflowers, and then walking in the graveyard looking for his grave where he's buried next to his brother Theo, and there was a sunflower that was there, and it was just, it was just so peaceful and beautiful.
Somebody put a sunflower on his gravestone?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so beautiful. That must have been a moment.
It was such a moment. Oh. It was just such a moment. And just then being able to take what I had learned that trip and to transfer to my students. I taught first grade at the time, and they love learning about different artists, and they love learning about Vincent van Gogh, and to see his graveyard and his gravestone was just really special to them.
And you were traveling with a group of teachers.
Were they art teachers? Our art teacher who would come to schools, and she totally changed the way that I taught art to my students.
Wow.
And she taught summer classes, and she said, you know, I would love to take a group of teachers over to Europe.
Nice.
And there were only, I think, 6 or 7 of us who ended up going, but it was just a really nice small group.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Amsterdam, and just, again, all the amazing art there, whether it was Rembrandt's home, the Vincent van Gogh Museum, which was amazing. We took a bus and a train to get to the Kröller-Müller Museum.
That's a beautiful museum in the middle of a park.
Oh, it is absolutely beautiful.
Lots of Van Gogh.
Oh, just all the different artwork there was so beautiful. And to me, there was this orange sculpture outside that is like the sister of a sculpture that we have here in Milwaukee.
Huh.
And so it was like, wow, Milwaukee followed us to Holland.
Oh.
And then, so going from that and then going inside to the museum itself and just, oh my gosh, all the beautiful artwork.
This was in the 1990s, right?
Yes, it was 1991.
Well, you're a teacher. I'm just curious. What do teachers think about the new priorities these days where we're really not affording art teachers anymore?
Well, I'm retired. I retired 5 years ago. And to me, not having the art in the schools is a crime. I just saw how my student just blossomed so much in learning about art and in learning about great art and learning about a variety of artists.
Well, good for you for traveling and for dedicating a career to teaching and sharing your love of this kind of culture. I hope that's gratifying for you.
Oh, it has been. And it's just been wonderful just to see my students just love art. And it really was special to them.
Laura from Wisconsin, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
We're at 877-333-RICK, and radio@ricksteves.com is our email address. William's calling in from Miami. Hey, William.
Hey, Rick.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Thank you for taking it. I specifically go to Europe every year to see the art. Well, I haven't gone for the past 4 years. I finally went back in March, and I hit Berlin, Cologne, Antwerp, Bruges, and Brussels. And, of course, I had to hit the museums in each and every one of those cities. I've been to all of them before, but I go back to visit these paintings.
You must enjoy the Flemish primitives if you like those cities.
Oh, yeah. They're my absolute favorites. And for me, there's no experience like standing in front of a work of art and just drinking it in.
But, William, you're able to look at it and let it take you back because these Flemish primitives, they go back 500 or 600 years, don't they?
Oh, yeah. My favorite's Van Eyck, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And to see the detail, it's like going back in time. It's you look at the stubble on the beard and the faces, and you look at the beautiful stitching and the embroidery, and you look at the lovingly put together rooms and the tenderness of people holding hands, and it just takes you back.
It does. And like I say, I have to go back every few years and visit these different paintings. It takes you to out-of-the-way places, like, you know, places you wouldn't go to, like Colmar and Bone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who the hell would go to Bone usually? But to see that Last Judgment altar piece by, you know, Van der Weyden.
In the hospice there, in the medieval hospital.
Oh yeah.
That's what people looked at on their last days when they were being eased out of this life and into the next.
Yep, and I mean, it's just, you know, it's just amazing to see this stuff. And the sad thing is, I'm probably the same age you are. I turned 69 in April.
And you're 1 month older than me, old man.
Yeah, I know. And I went back this time and I realized this might be the last time I see this.
Oh, no. You're just a kid.
Yeah, as I'm walking away from my favorite pieces, like I keep casting a look back over my shoulder, like I did that with the Death Marat when I was in Brussels.
Oh,
and you know, just as you know, I say, this might be the last time I ever see this.
Yeah,
you know,
I got to admit.
I'll go next year to Italy and, you know, visit the different art there. It's great. It really is. And
well, it's a blessing to be able to see that and not only see it and check it off of some list, but to see it and be moved by it. When you go to Antwerp, when you go to Bruges, when you go to Brussels, those are great cities if you love the exquisite detail and exquisite.
Or you go into You go to Vienna, go to the Bruegel Room there.
You know, when I was filming at the Kunsthistorisch Museum, is that what it's called, or the Alte? It's the Kunsthistorisch in Vienna. We were doing our TV show on the whole sweep of European art history, and it occurred to me there is enough great art in that museum to almost do a show just without ever leaving that museum. You could spend days in the Kunsthistorisch Museum in
that and the
Vienna.
Prado. I'm so jealous of you being able to, I know you're paying an arm and a leg for this, but be able to go to these museums when they're closed and film this.
And the Prado, you're right. The last two museums we filmed in was the Prado and the Kunsthistorisch Museum. And at the Prado, it is expensive to be there with the TV crew. We had 60 minutes, and they gave us 5 paintings we could shoot. So we had 10 minutes at each painting and 2 minutes to walk from one painting to the next and get set up. And we got the most out of it.
You barely had more time than I did.
Hey, William, thanks so much for calling in, and keep traveling. It's the Fountain of Youth.
Will do.
All right.
For as long as I can.
Take care. Enjoy the art.
Bye. Bye, Rick. Be good.
Thanks. And Stacy's calling in from Richmond in Texas. Hey, Stacy.
Hello. I am so excited about this topic because I started my list of art that I wanted to see live when I was a little kid.
Huh.
And I finally got the chance on your tours to go see some of my favorites. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, what are some of your favorites?
Well, I love the School of Athens in the Vatican. I think it has the most incredible structure of any work I've ever seen because there's a lot going on in that painting.
Oh, yeah.
But yet you don't really feel overwhelmed by it, I don't think.
Raphael was just, he was just on a roll with that one. And then when you think of the structure of that, there's the Sacred Conversation or whatever on the other side of the room, and they both look at each other, and they kind of, these two paintings talk to each other. And then when you know what to look for, you see all the great painters from Raphael's generation, the Renaissance, in the setting of the School of Athens, which portrays ancient Greece.
Now, my hubby was a little bit worried when we went to see that because he was afraid that I was going to be disappointed in it.
Hmm.
Seeing it live, but I have never been disappointed in one of my pilgrimage works. And in fact, in going to see those works, I've encountered works that maybe I didn't particularly like when I studied them in school,
mm-hmm.
but that I learned to appreciate when I saw them.
So you saw the Madonna with the Long Neck by Parmigiano. Was that one like that?
Yes. I always thought it was such an odd work. Because I would say she has a neck like a swan, but it's not even that graceful. I think it's like some sort of odd garden hose.
That's perfect, an odd garden hose. I've been trying to figure out how to describe this Madonna with the long neck. Of course, it's Mannerist style, so that's all about elongation. But to call it a garden hose, it's perfect, a slippery garden hose.
Yes, and so, you know, I didn't like it when I studied it, but when you go to the Uffizi and you see it, it's such a huge work, and it's way up high on the wall, and so you have to look up at it, and it changes the perspective, and I was drawn to her face, and the look on her face was a look that if you have ever seen a mother with their new baby, you'll immediately recognize it. It's that look of, oh my God, isn't he perfect? Isn't he the most beautiful baby ever?
Oh, that's so beautiful. And you're absolutely right. And to stand there in front of that and have the time and the appreciation just to let it soak in, what a delightful experience.
And the universality of it just really, really struck me. And it may never be one of my most favorite works, and it's certainly not my most favorite style, but I think I have an appreciation for it now.
Yeah.
And that's what I really love is those moments of appreciation that you didn't see coming.
That, you know, that's one thing that I find very exciting is if I'm able to broaden what I can appreciate by visiting something in person and having good information. I'm really into this notion that the more context and understanding you bring to a site or a great piece of art or architecture, the more you get out of it, the more you appreciate it, the better it is as an experience.
And the more you learn, the more you're able to learn, the more things that you have to draw on when you see new works of art.
And to think of all the places you've gone to and enjoyed, and you must have a list of places you want to go yet and appreciate. What's on your dream list for experiencing art in Europe?
Well, next up is Madrid, because there's two in Madrid in two different museums. Of course, I have to see Guernica.
Uh-huh.
That was a totally new way of portraying war from anything that had ever come before.
And that was sort of like proto, that was sort of like cubism, wasn't it? So it's a different kind of collage effect on the art. And talk about a powerful topic to talk about the horrors of the first aerial bombardment in human history when Hitler's Luftwaffe destroyed the city of Guernica in Basque country in Spain.
And then the other one to see in Madrid is Las Meninas. Talk about a work that has some intriguing composition there.
Oh, yeah, by Velázquez.
Yes.
A lot of people call that the greatest painting in European history. I'd like to travel with you, Stacy. Hey, thanks so much for your call, and best wishes in your continued travel and art appreciation.
Thank you so much, and thank you for bringing art to us.
Oh, thanks a lot. Happy travels.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You'll find more about our guests at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
My public television miniseries, Rick Steves' Art of Europe, takes you on an exciting sweep through the entire awe-inspiring story of European art history in 6 hours. Watch the series from the Parthenon to Picasso on your local station or stream it on PBS Passport or at ricksteves.com.